There's this saying here where they say, don't build for the view. So generally when people take a place, the first thing they do is they put a big wall around it, right? And so you then create your Bali, your image of Bali within your four walls.
Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today I talk with veteran travel writer Stuart MacDonald, who I quote in two separate sections of my book, The Vagabond's Way. I think Stuart's writing has always resonated with me because it champions going slow and traveling in local economies and being skeptical of the comforts and promises of the commercial travel industry. Our conversation took place in Bali, where Stuart lives and where my wife Kiki and I stopped off on our travels this summer. Kiki is actually a part of this conversation, and while she wasn't mic'd up, you can hear her chime in from time to time as we talk about things like how social media influencers have transformed what tourists seek out in places like Bali. We talk about how traditional travel media has, in fact, given over in large part to the algorithm-driven narratives that one finds on social media, and how this has a way of excluding cultural context and flattening our understanding of other places and cultures. We talk about the mythos of places like Bali and how these places can come to be seen as fantastical tourist dreamscapes, for better and for worse. We talk about the role ghosts and black magic in the spirit world play in the lives of Balinese people in ways that travelers rarely understand. Kiki and I had just traveled in the South Pacific island nation of Vanuatu, where magic also plays an important role in local belief systems, so we talk about that as well. In general, we talk about the time required in establishing a meaningful understanding of the places we visit as travelers. I might point out that Kiki and I flew to Bali by way of Fiji, Vanuatu, and Australia on a flight itinerary designed by my longtime sponsor, AirTrex, which specializes in multi-stop and round-the-world flights. More on how to save money by designing your own vagabonding journeys with AirTrex can be found at airtrex.com. Our conversation starts with Stuart talking about why he moved to Bali and why he keeps a laid-back writing office in the sleepy oceanside setting of West Bali. Let's listen in.
So this is my shack. Okay. We're in West Bali, about 10 minutes west of Madewi in Jembrana Regency. It's just the place I go to escape the far south, you know. Come here with my dog and write and sweep and not much else really. That's the joy of it, you know.
Nice. It's beautiful here. I can see the beach straight away in one direction, and there's some agricultural lands behind us. When you say escape the south, what do you mean escape the south? Because some people might think Bali. I want to escape to Bali. What does he mean, escape the south?
Well, there's lots of different parts to Bali, and my family house is in South Bali, next to shush. Sorry,
that's Sky, by the way. She's guarding us.
Sky Govinda, my Bali dog. I live next to Seminyak in the south, so it's really close to the epicenter of the tourism scene. So it's very congested, very. In places very dirty, the beach gets filthy, the traffic's horrendous, and there's lots of tourists there that are not really why I came here. We're here, like we're surrounded, like on we have the ocean out to one side, and bananas on that side at the moment. On the other two sides, they're growing melons, but other times of the year it will be rice, chilies, beans. And you sort of see the cycle of the land, and it's a different sort of clock here compared to the south, where it's, it's Friday night, let's go out and get hammered kind of thing. Huh. Here it's time to plow the land or watch the rice grow or weed it or spray it with chemicals. you know, it's not perfect. But yeah, so that's about the difference, yeah.
And then ambient noise is the ocean. It's not some sort of sound machine.
No, that's the waves.
The mics are picking up the waves of the ocean.
The funny thing is that when I'm here, I don't hear it. Like, then the surf here can get very big. It can be very loud. But I just don't hear it. But then as soon as I get back to the south, I have this ringing in my ears all the time because I've actually been sitting next to this sound machine 24/7, you know. It's almost like using white noise, you know. The funny thing is, like, when I write here, like, I often play music, and I really like Led Zeppelin. And so I'll be sitting here writing, and I'll have Led Zeppelin playing, and it's loud, but it's not super loud, and there's nobody around here. And then one day I walked back one block of the paddock to take a photo of the house from that side, and there were farmers out there at the time doing something with the rice. And I realized that you could hear Led Zeppelin just as loud back there. And so, like, yeah, I'm like, geez, I've just become one of those noise-making tourists, you know, those white guys. So I don't play it quite so loud anymore, you know.
Well, as an aside, and this ties into something that was in my head when I woke up tomorrow,
yes,
is the Immigrant Song and Bali High from the music South Pacific, is that the same song?
No.
No.
Bali High! Bali High! Bali High!
When you put it that way.
God.
What about the mythos of Bali? I mean, Bali has sort of been a name like Timbuktu or Tahiti, you know, where people dream of this faraway place that they project their fantasies onto. How did Bali become a dreamscape in the Western consciousness, and how have you seen it change?
Well, it's funny, people often say it's a creation. Sorry, excuse me. People say it's a creation of the Dutch colonialists, that they sort of reinvented it into this tourism thing. But that sort of, like, takes the power away from the Balinese. You know, Bali was here long, and the Balinese were here long before the Dutch were here. And they're still here, and the Dutch are long gone,
yeah,
you know. Although the other place down the beach, there's actually a Dutch guy who owns that place down there.
Hmm.
But anyway. Yeah, so the Dutch portrayed it as this, like, classic Far East exotic kind of thing, you know, with the classic art. And then in the 20s and 30s, there was an influx of, I guess you'd call them, the creative class of artists and that kind of thing. And then anthropologists came through, and Margaret Mead and all that whole set. So it's had that sort of classic image, sort of much like if you look at, you know, the old airline posters from the 60s and how they portray Tahiti, right? There's an equivalent of that for Bali. And it would generally be like a woman in the rice fields that's naked from the top, like she's not, she's topless, and there's a volcano in the background. Something like that, you know. It has morphed considerably since then, and you can sort of put your finger on a lot of different things. Like, some people pick, like, Eat, Pray, Love as an example of a injection, and, like, the whole New Age thing, yoga, blah blah blah, all that kind of stuff. Then much more recently, like the, what do they call them, the remote workers, global nomads, all that kind of stuff. But there's lots of cycles of different scenes, you know, even in, say, Canggu, which is like one of the very high profile areas of the island, I guess. It was very close to where we live.
For tourists.
For tourists, yeah. Mm-hmm. When we were here, when we first came here, or whatever it was, 17 years ago or something, it was predominantly just rice field.
Canggu,
yeah. And then there was this series of waves that came through it. There was the Australian FIFO workers, so the mine workers who were, they would work in Australia, but then they would holiday up here. So they were cashed up, and so they sort of were part of the first wave of Western development in Canggu. And then there was a wave of Russians came through, then a wave of Chinese came through, then another wave of Russians. And then it became very high profile with the remote workers.
Digital nomads.
Digital nomads, thank
yeah.
you. And so now when you look at it, it's like completely unrecognizable to what it was even just 15 years ago. And so for me, like I said, I've been going around circles here for 3 decades, and I can't think of anywhere in the region that I've seen change as quickly as Bali, as that particular part of Bali yet. When we consider where we're sitting now, I've got like the first edition of Lonely Planet to Bali, which was in 1984. Mm. And so it lists the temple at the end of this beach, Pura Rambutsiri. Mm-hmm. And if you read about what they said then about it, and you looked around us now, it is pretty much unchanged. Mm. They could have taken that copy from 84 and put it in the 2024 book, and it would still be accurate. So the changes in Bali have not been uniform. So some, like tourism, is very concentrated in particular areas that's driven like by hotel development, by tour operators, by travel media, by influencers, like all sorts of really focused on a few key elements. And that has just, you know, sort of snowballed upon itself while everything else is not so much changed, you know? Like, again, in that 84 book, you can look at other, with due respect, secondary towns or tertiary towns that made it into that first edition. Now, they're no longer in the guidebook, but the towns are still there. People are still there. You know, life goes on. But they haven't changed in the same way as somewhere that has had a protracted attention from tourists, and there's like what results from that is a profound difference in what the location is, you know. But there's many different strands that sort of push that, you know. It's, you can't sort of point to one group and say, yeah, this is Australian FIFO workers that screwed it up, you know. It's a team effort.
FIFO workers?
Fly in, fly out.
Fly in, fly out.
Yeah, so they were mine workers, mostly in Western Australia, and they could...
Mine workers?
Yeah, working, digging crap out of the ground.
Yeah. No joking.
Yeah, and there were very good tax advantages to how they would structure their work, so they were very well paid anyway. But then you had to spend, I think it was 186 days a year outside of Australia, so then you weren't paying tax. But you weren't paying tax here either. Mm. And so people ended up with a lot of loose change. And so that was one of the initial drivers of property investment into Canggu in particular. Yeah.
How far from here is Canggu, but driving on an average traffic day?
On the motorbike, it takes me to Canggu about, depending on traffic, about an hour, 45 minutes going the back way.
Yeah. So Canggu is revolutionarily changed.
Yep.
It's a rural place that's now full of Westerners and bars and off co-working spaces.
Infinity pools
and Pacific Rim, whatever. I mean, if you want fantastic food, Canggu has it. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. It has an incredible food scene.
That's what I've read.
Like, right.
Not just Balinese.
I mean, it is.
Whatever.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, there are good Indonesian places to eat there. But if you were to sum it all up, that would be the minority, you know. Exceptional food scene. But if you were to take somebody who had been there, say, 20 years ago and hadn't been there since, and then you put them on the main road, say, on Bada Belong, and say, walk down the main road, they would not recognize almost anything. You know, it's, I would say, unrecognizable. And like, from my personal opinion, not for the better. Mm. I mean, there's been inflated land prices, so the local people get priced out of their land, you know, all those kind of ancillary effects that come with tourism.
You said that there's a beautiful, peaceful temple here that from the 1984 version of The Lonely Planet is pretty much the way it was in 1984. It's an hour and 45 minutes away from this place that's completely transformed.
Correct.
In a certain sense, over-tourism is a catchphrase, but it's sort of ghettoized, for lack of a better word. Like, over-tourism seems isolated to certain, more than ever, to certain areas. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, yeah, I mean, Canggu developed in part because it has a couple of quite nice waves. Mm-hmm. But then, say, Madewi, which is very close to where you're staying, has one of Bali's best breaks.
Okay.
But, what do they call it? The left-hand wave or something?
Yeah. Like that. But people, most people would drive up to see it. They wouldn't stay out here because, say, 10 years ago, there were still places to stay, but not as many. Like, as you know, there's some very nice places to stay out here now. But outside of surfing, there's not a lot of things to do, I guess you would say. I mean, you could say the same about Canggu, to be honest. I mean, it's not like it's a wealth of museums or art galleries or something. It's all boutiques and shops and whatever. It's a self-perpetuating kind of thing. And when it started to develop, it was coincided with Airbnb becoming much more prevalent, and so people wanting the villa experience rather than staying in a hotel or a homestay or whatever. And so, I mean, for a while there, I mean, still in the right area of Canggu, you could have like an incredible rice field view, but it's kind of just don't look to the left or right, you know. It's very, there's this saying here where they say, don't build for the view. So generally when people take a place, the first thing they do is they put a big wall around it, right? And so you then create your Bali, your image of Bali within your four walls. So when I took this place, the owner, his first thing was, do you want to build a wall? And I'm like, why would I want to build a wall? You know, because, I mean, look, you may, why?
So we're sitting in under a roof in an open air space, but yeah. And there's a wall around the bedroom area and a wall around the kitchen area, and the rest is.
Yeah, my wife wanted those.
Okay.
But the difference is, I mean, there's nothing around here. Where in, say, Canggu or any other developed part of Bali, it becomes further to. Like, there's also, like, some people are concerned about security or privacy or whatever. But it tends to become very inward looking. So you, like, the soil is so fertile here. Like, I mean, you can grow tremendous gardens, and you've got your horizon pool and your, and whatever. And, you know, that's all you need for some Instagram props, you know. Yeah, it's just a different, it's not something that appeals to me personally, but I mean, obviously it works for a lot of people.
Well, I want to talk about that specifically, sort of the infinity pool Instagram aspect of the Bali experience, because I think that has arisen since I started as a backpacker in this part of the world 25 years ago. And so we talk about different influences, sort of like the Dutch fantasies that were superimposed on here 100 years ago. The Eat, Pray, Love thing, certainly, the book and in the movie, certainly, when you talk about influence, the idea of creating an idea of Bali in the travel imaginary, certainly that influenced things. But now, since that time, since the time of the book and the movie, there are literally these people called influencers. I'm air quoting here. My listeners can't see it, but I'm putting air quotes. So I'm curious about how you've seen the influencer scene arise here, because to me it feels like there's a very concentrated influencer scene, and how it affects, be it for good or for bad or for neutral, how have you seen influencers affect this place that you know pretty well?
Okay, so if you imagine, like, at one end of the spectrum, we have, like, the long-form National Geographic piece. And then you come along a bit, and you've got, like, your typical airline mag kind of thing. And then the next progression from that is, say, like, travel bloggers. And then the next thing is Instagram and Instagram stories. And if you look along that continuum, they're becoming shorter and more concentrated and much shallower. Right, there's far more depth in a 10,000 word piece than a 1,000 word piece, than a 500 word travel blog, to a 60 word Instagram caption. And I mean, who reads the captions on Instagram? So, and I don't even know if you can put captions on TikTok. I don't know. Am I showing my age?
You can superimpose words over
it,
right?
Right. Yeah.
Sounds about right.
Our collective age here.
Our age is showing.
Yeah, we're showing our age. But when you think about it like that, then your window is very narrow, right? There's only so much you can say in one picture or a short video or whatever. So obviously it becomes more concentrated, right? So there's particularly beautiful places, or not beautiful, but particularly photogenic things, places, locations in Bali that have become, they're on the top of every Instagrammer list. So, you know, it's the gates of heaven, it's Kling Kling on Nusa Penida, it'll be like some sunset shot down at Ulu's or something like that. It's, and then to capitalize on that, there's tour companies that run like an Instagram tour of Bali. So one that Get Your Guide was running was, for a period, their number one selling tour in Asia Pacific. And so where people would pay, I don't know, starting at say $100 a head or something like that, and they would be carted from one attraction to the other by car or van, and you would get to, say, the swing. You get out, get on the swing, take a photo, get back on the van and go to the next place, and so on and so forth.
And by
so,
swing, you mean the scenic?
The scenic, scene, it's like the classic.
In Instagram.
I mean, if you go up to where most of those, I mean, there's a swing freaking everywhere now, but I mean, you go up to one of the swing locations and there'll be like dozens of them. Like, it's not novel anymore. There's probably an interesting story to go and find the original swing.
Ooh.
You know, that would be an interesting story. But anyway, so the byproduct of this kind of thing is that the people doing those are forever reinforcing the same images, and they're spending no time in the actual place other than the requisite time to take the photo. So from the local community's point of view, there's very little value the sort of staying there. I mean, they can, like, I don't know, buy a coffee or something like that, but, and I'm sure some people do stay there. You know, I know people do stay there, but this kind of thing of bunny hopping from one spot to another solely to take a photo, it is just a peculiar, I mean, it's not unique to Bali. And it's just a strange product, I think. It very much undervalues what really, it isn't the swing with a rice field or the temple gates that make Bali the special place it is. And you're not, you can't sum that up in a photo. You couldn't sum that up in an 8,000 word piece in National Geographic either. It is something that you need to, like I used to say, like, to appreciate Bali, you need to earn it, right? Like, my grandma, rest her soul, could go to Thailand and have a holiday, no problems, right? Thailand is easy. But I say, in general with Indonesia, but also with Bali, you need to earn it. I mean, yeah, you can get off and do an Instagram tour or whatever, but to really even scratch the surface of what really makes this place special, you have to work a little bit harder.
And how do you do that? How do you earn it?
I'm still trying to earn it. I don't know, you know? I think it's, the answer to that is very, like, if I think back about the experiences that I've had of, that have marked me here, they were very unusual. I mean, in our house down in the south, we have a ghost that lives in the pool, for example.
In the pool?
In the pool.
Wow.
And
swimming pool.
Yeah,
okay.
And we only found out, I won't get into, I'll tell you the story later, but so that is like one, but then tangentially related to that was when I was helping a group who were looking around here, we went to see a practitioner of black magic, and he was the real deal if this is your sort of cricket pitch, you know. And that was an evening that I won't forget. But it doesn't even need to be these kind of hokey pokey things. It can be as something as simple as just being at the base of a waterfall by yourself in the jungle. And it's pristine and it's clean, and there's just that that humidity and spray and in the air and this life that you could slice, that there's lots of water. I've been sitting at the base of lots and lots of waterfalls, but there's some here where there's just something different to it. And I'm not saying that you have to stay here for 15 years or whatever to experience this, but I think it's going to be much more difficult to experience that when you're in a queue of 100 people waiting to take a photo at the gates of heaven, you know? I mean, that's a unique experience as well, I guess, you know, like...
Waiting in line with 100 other tourists?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you know. Yeah, I think it's a tricky one, you know.
I wonder if ghosts would be an interesting metric, because you mentioned there's a ghost in your well here, up the coast. And one of the first things we noticed when we were driving here is that there are actually cloths that are hung around trees and statues to sort of as a barrier, I guess, for the spirit world, to protect in both directions. And actually, having just been in Vanuatu, where...
You mentioned the black magic sort of thing, and like learning about these different levels of spirituality, if you will. One of the most remarkable nights we had was in this really far away part of Malekula, and because we put in the time, it took like 3 hours of jostling in this in the back of a truck to get there, and like there was a rat in the place that we're staying. The toilet was truly one of the...
They hadn't had tourists since before COVID.
We didn't touch the toilet. It was much better just to pee outside. It was hard travel for me in particular. But there was something that just opened up in like the 11th hour of the evening when the boys were back from drinking kava. And they just very casually started talking about the fact that, oh yeah, you can fly here.
Right.
And well, and a lot of the magic nowadays is for ill. Just as...
Very matter of fact.
As, like, what are we going to have for breakfast in the morning? And that felt like we, to use your word, like we earned it, because we'd hung out with these
right.
men for hours, you
well,
know?
Well, on the subject of flight, I have very peculiar dreams here. Every time when I sleep here, I have peculiar dreams.
In this house?
Yeah, this house.
Specifically.
And so my wife is always like, my wife is always like, oh, it's because the house is haunted, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so one night I woke up. It was like 4 a.m, something like that. And I could hear a helicopter. And I'm like, okay. So I got up and walked out, and just out to sea, a couple of 100 meters offshore, there was a helicopter. And it was maybe 50, maybe 100 meters off the surface. It was like 4 a.m, so it was dark, but I could see its lights. I could hear the sound of the helicopter and everything. And I thought, what on earth is a helicopter doing there? And I thought, maybe it's a search and rescue, because like the fishermen, their boats sometimes sink out here. But I can't imagine a boat sinking here and them actually calling a helicopter for it. And it was very, very peculiar. And then as quickly as it came, it just flew off. And so I thought, okay, that's strange. And I was trying to figure out what it was. Like, was it a drug drop or whatever? But it was all like seemed too way too complicated for what it was. Anyway, a couple of days later, Agung, who's the landowner, was up here helping me out with something. And I told him the story. And I'm like, I don't understand what was going on. And he said, oh, that's the magic helicopter. And I'm like, okay. And that was it. I mean, there was no further explanation than it's the magic helicopter. And so I'm still baffled as to what it was. Like, I know I was awake. It wasn't a dream. But to Gong, it was like, that seemed like a perfectly respectable answer, you know.
Did you say, what is a magic helicopter?
It's all I got out of him, you know. The magic helicopter. So, yeah, I don't know.
So now that's your password for everything, right?
Yeah, yes, exactly. Yeah.
Magic helicopter
123. Yeah.
I think in a sense at the base of this all is ways of seeing, you know, that the Dutch came and gave us a certain way of seeing Bali.
Yeah.
And that influencers come and they give us this tighter circle of what swings and, you know, slow motion flowing infinity pools, yet a certain amount of slow travel combined with local belief systems allows you to see and experience magic helicopters, maybe.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, what's interesting is you would say the Instagrammers get like an oversized amount of interest for what they do, and certainly for what they're highlighting. But then you have operations like, say, what are they called? Ashtankara Trail, which is an organization that do a 10-day walk in the mountains, and you stay in local villages, and it's all about observing and learning something from traditional Balinese ways of life. Now, I haven't done it myself because it's a bit out of my budget, but I know friends who have done it and have said it's just been an incredible experience. So it's great to see things like that working and happening, but they just don't get the same column inches as a horizon pool and a beautiful couple or whatever. And it's also that when you look at it, what is traditionally gets all the views, there's no context. There's no, hey, I'm walking around wearing nothing but a pair of Speedos, and that's fine. And it's like, well, no, it's not actually fine. But when I go down to my local supermarket in Seminyak and I see a tourist who is just wearing Speedos, I'm like, that's not okay, dude, you know? But, I mean, that's what social media is presenting as the place. And, I mean, I'm sure he doesn't go into the supermarket at home wearing just Speedos. I don't know, maybe he does. But it's not a culturally aware way to behave. And so when you've gone from the National Geographic piece to a 2-second slot on TikTok, you have a very limited window to give people anything other than the most simplistic kind of view of the place and how one should behave. What people need to take into account, you know, like their impact on the area and all of that, those kind of things, are difficult to get across in a 2-second slot on TikTok or whatever.
Even with the longer videos that are around 7 minutes, like one that we watched yesterday, they all follow the same format. I'm going to give you the top 10 things you shouldn't do in Bali, or the top 7 places to go in Bali. It's like, they've got to be in a listicle, they follow a very specific format, even if they're a little bit longer than, say, the 20 seconds on TikTok. And so it's like, okay, you're hemmed in with how you can disseminate this information.
Well, I mean, like we were talking about earlier, that book by Kyle Chaika. I'm not sure how you say his
surname. We'll put it in the show notes, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. But where he describes it as a flattening.
Yeah.
And when I first hit that term, I'm like, my God, I've never thought about it like that. But it is exactly what happens, is that when you suck all the nuance and context and understanding out of something, you end up with something very flat, you know? And there's not so much to learn from that. It's an interesting field. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like it's expectation setting too. When your expectations of Bali involve shopping in your Speedo, or at least sort of like, you know, maybe the National Geographic article would have at least had pictures of temples and native lifeways. Where now, if it's like the top 10 things to do or not to do in Bali, and it involves a swing and running in slow motion towards an infinity pool, then maybe it's not personal malice that has the guy doing culturally inappropriate things like going to the store in a Speedo, but he just thinks that that is the world he's in.
Well, yeah, I mean, if every, I mean, I'm sorry that we're picking on the Speedo seller.
Sorry, Speedo guy.
Speedo man deserves it.
But, I mean, if every image you get of a place is of people wearing Speedos or bikinis or whatever, then it's not unreasonable the people then take from that is reasonable behavior. Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, pick up a book. You know, it's easy to sort of say, oh, it's the algorithm's fault. You know, it's Instagram's fault. But people need to, you need to want to learn, right? If you, if you're traveling to a place and you have no interest in picking up a book about it, I mean, realistically, what are you doing there? I mean, maybe you do just want to have a holiday on the beach with a palm tree and a couple of cheap beers or whatever, and that's fine. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that to a point, but I mean, you could be in Bali or, you know, Bermuda or Barbados or wherever that starts with B. I mean, it doesn't really matter. I mean, everything is just interchangeable. And to sort of say, well, the algorithm didn't tell me any better, seems like a cop-out, you know? And I think, you know, if you want to be a better traveler, then it pays to do a bit more research than what you get scrolling when you're sitting on the loo, you know? Tourism is a very complex thing, and it's very easy, very tempting to pick like a very simple target and saying, okay, this is a problem because of that dude,
right,
the dude in the Speedos or whatever. But generally it's far, far, far more complex than that. But as the individual, there are simple things that the individual can do to at least mitigate some of what they're doing. These are not challenges that Bali is facing alone, whether it's Bali or Venice or whatever, it doesn't really matter. It's always the same challenge, you know? And at the end of the day, if you want there to be, if you want somewhere to still be worth visiting for the next generation, not only visiting, but living in, like, this whole thing of where residents, the people who are from there, are like an afterthought. They're really just a background in an Instagram photo. That is like one of the biggest problems within the travel industry, is that it is so, the customer is always right. It is so focused on the traveler and the traveler experience. While when you're looking at the impact of that experience, how that flows onto, what do they call it, an externality. So what flows onto the surrounds, the people who live there, the environment, waste control, like pick your poison, they're not really being brought into consideration. It's like, okay, I'm gonna use a bamboo straw, or I'm gonna use a refillable water container or whatever. Yes, for sure, do that. But try harder.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you're not even doing the low-hanging fruit, I mean, stay at home.
This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. More about everything that was just mentioned, including information about Stuart McDonald and his essays and newsletters and websites, can be found in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. And as always, you can contact me with insights or questions at deviate@rolfpotts.com. This episode was produced by Cedar Van Tassel, who also does the theme music. Thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in for future episodes of Deviate with Rolf Potts.